Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Cookie Jar Golf Podcast. I am Tom Mills and today we are looking at part two of our tour roundup. This again is part of the Netherlands series content, which comprises of seven films that we're going to be releasing on YouTube and a number of podcasts to go with it. Again, a big shout out to our series sponsor FootJoy, who helped make this trip a reality. We're really lucky to get partner with such an iconic brand, and FootJoy, the number one shoe on tour, trusted by more PGA players than any other. We're huge fans of the Premier FootJoy range. They come in five designs with a Packard, Tarlow, Flint, Field and Wicklow, all named with a purpose. Classic and traditional, just how we like them, but also really comfortable, with great performance, and they wear brilliantly. You can even change out the soft spikes for some metal ones if you want to get really niche and hear the crunching of metal spikes on a car park. But anyway, on to the podcast.
Watch this.
So wrapping up from Kenema, I think, you know, where do we leave it? I was in love with the place. I was amazed how good it was. I felt like the kid that didn't want to pack it in at soft play that was kind of been dragged out kicking and screaming, if I'm honest. And that was the only sad part, really.
I think for me, and we discussed this, so this isn't something that's going to be new to your ears, but something that I wouldn't mind putting on air. I think if Kenema was in the UK, it would be a lot more prominent in rankings than it is.
Like, I don't rankings think it's are
in so bogus,
the world
top
they?
100. But it's, I mean, I've not played all top 100 courses.
Well, you know, here's a great example with the Dutch tour. Like, you know, I don't want to talk about rankings because the danger is it clouds the judgment. But people can go and look at that. The courses we were playing, two of them were world top 100 courses. The others don't feature. They are highly rated courses within the Netherlands. But I would say anyone I've spoken to and every one of our hosts that we asked and said, where's your favourite, whether it was their home club or otherwise, gave you a completely different ordering of the five as to what they were. So it was so subjective. Mm. And yet if you just hunted on rankings, you're going to be like, you know, I've got to go and tick off A and B.
Which I think shows you the strength and depth across the country.
Kenema was so good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good.
It's interesting because we're going to, you know, the timings are going to be whether we do the Eclectic 18 before or after this pod, but
we'll do it at the end of the series, I think.
Spoiler alert, Kenema doesn't appear tons. However, I've been quite open and said I think it was my favourite course of the trip.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
But the thing is, it's like choosing your favourite kids to steal your line.
I was
in
love with so many of them. But like Kenema,
ironic, is the only person who's actually not got kids on out of the three contributors. Yeah, but yeah,
it was just
I only have one kid.
I think some of the other places, like Japan, was obviously breathtaking, and some of the other had like really good standout holes that you're like, yo, I can't, this is amazing. And perhaps Kenema didn't have, for me, a whole bunch of real standout holes, but I felt that it had the highest average level of and flow, average level hole and flow for me, I thought.
Yeah, I'm trying to think how to...
It's just the intangibles though, isn't it? I think.
I love the feeling of the clubhouse. I love that first hole, the ninth hole, the tenth hole.
The golf club above the sign outside, you know, it's just...
They all just play into that feeling.
Another lovely little practice area down to just off the side of the ninth on the B course. It was just, for me, it's all about the experience you have, isn't it? And we stood in the car park in the pitch black, but that allowed me to basically film the sunrise there. And I just stood there with the sun rising above the clubhouse from where we were. And I was like, yeah, this place is just...
You probably droned all of the A-holes and none of the B and C that we played. But
also, when the light came out, because it kind of was overcast for the first half an hour and then the light hit it. And then when it was overcast, you're like, okay, yeah, because you mentioned from the clubhouse, you're quite a high vantage point. You look out across the course and think, cool, I can see that. You just go play down there and that's fairly flat. And you play up to there, that's fine. And then the light hit it and it was like, whoa. Mm. Like, it's so ripply. It's so broken. It's just like there's shadows everywhere. Mm. And it was like, this is incredible. Another interesting point, maybe interesting to some, not to others. grass pathways.
Yeah, good discussion topic.
Shades of raw pork call.
Yeah, but the thing about grass pathways is, you say, you know, you've probably droned all of it. What was interesting, because of the grass pathways and the cut grass between green and tea, from the drone, even without having ever played it, you can run the whole course because you can see how it moves through the land because of those grass pathways.
It's very obvious. It creates
Yeah, Lucas said to us, oh, you don't need a course planner because there's no signage out there, which, by the way, was really cool. Like, it's literally, there's no signage whatsoever. It's just like, just find your way around.
I mean, it definitely doesn't win the course furniture award that we were talking about.
Well, I don't know, though. Like, I like that minimalist sort of... Just go out and,
yeah, that's exactly. But there was no furniture around. To rank.
They're all, you know, you're all members.
The
of
only
playing,
furniture
basically.
Out there was to a Nazi regime, but the bunkers, wasn't it? You know, it was.
I know what you're saying. Though. Yeah.
No, that's it literally is the only. That's like one of the there's no actual. There wasn't. They didn't do any real course furniture. There. It was all natural.
But it's
and the thing
the
is, it was all coming from Christian and Lucas and seeing the chairman of Greens and the head greenkeeper who were totally invested in their craft. You know, they were dead serious about it. Like they were. That you could tell Christian was giving inordinate amount of time of his life just to make that course as good as it can be. And he was just so invested in it. It's like there's guys we meet all over the place that are like that. But I think his wife plays there. I think his kids play there. It's back to this whole thing of like a really great family ethos.
Another guy just came out of high school that he's like, oh no, yeah, I'm like 42. You know?
I think maybe there's some of the elements of...
Yeah. I mean, terrific skin and just you know...
But I think if you'll indulge me a little bit, some of the comparison perhaps with the Birkdale stuff comes from there's a few touches of Hawtrey influence there. Some of the Greens have had some Hawtrey stuff done on. You can sometimes tell that's a bit of Hawtrey work, you know, thinking holes like back of the 13th green, I think it would be, long par four with the where it funnels entirely at the back. Right, you could, I was like, oh, is this some of the Hawtrey stuff? You can see that, which is maybe where it shows off a little bit of that. I think by having that some of that work, the knock-on effect is that it starts to demand tougher shots. Yeah, it's a little bit more penal, certainly in the approach to the greens where some of that had been done. I felt like Kenema asked for more shot variation than Nordvik, for instance. I felt like it was more multi-dimensional in terms of things it was asking.
Mm. I'd probably go with that.
So let's move on to Nordvik.
Which we then rushed on to Norway.
Which we had about, I think we had 11 minutes to get to, and it was a 20-minute journey to where Google Maps felt it was, and it turns out the golf club was at least another mile and a half further down the road. So we were totally fucked.
I know, we were up against it, weren't we? Still digesting the glipper as we've got in the car and just, pedal down.
That now.
Pedal down. I've driven as quickly and as carefully as I could. I mean, Sam definitely wanted me to go quicker, but I just was sure I was going to, you know, spread a cyclist across the windscreen if I wasn't careful. In fact, actually, we did see a cyclist who had been hit. They were okay.
She was okay. You could see
they were okay.
They were
just been
fine.
Knocked,
they were
just been knocked
fine.
Over. I think she might have been the only cyclist in the Netherlands who decided to wear a helmet. So that stood her in good stead. Amazing culture around
she's had
cycling.
Too many crashes in the past. And
but yeah, we got there. Lessons. No cyclists were harmed. All fine, safe. Made it there. Probably only 10 minutes late for the tea time.
First thoughts on the road bike?
Well, it was funny, wasn't it? We drove in, you're like, wow, this is like huge crazy. It's like, are we on
massive
Mars
shinny
or something?
Vibes.
Yes. Yeah, it's like Martian.
Yeah. Can we stop saying shinny vibes from a guy who's just never set foot at Shinnecock?
Never been to Long Island.
Yeah.
No, it was genuinely, I mean, it's ridiculous. It was like an alien landscape.
It was. And we've obviously got out of the car.
Can you explain why? What do you mean when you
changed,
say that?
So so you kind of like, you get out of the car and you climb up a hill to where the clubhouse is in the first tee is. And then you look out across the dunes. But this isn't like, we've talked about the dunes at Kenema. They're lovely and grassed and
these are everywhere, as far as the eye can see.
Yeah, it's just like, but these dunes are as literally as far as you can see, and it's all sand with like a tiny bit of marrow.
They're bare, aren't they?
And like, they're dynamic, apparently.
Bare sand, yeah.
Do you know what this meant? Dynamic sand dunes.
Yeah, they move, don't they? So, like, you have these huge, I don't want to say sand scrape, because that almost has a connotation nowadays of like something that's been almost artificially constructed, but they're like natural sandy kind of.
Have you seen that movie
Scrapes?
June? The new one
With Timothy Chalamet or whatever. No.
And it's in a desert up in like a yeah,
I think I've seen a trailer
it
for
like
it.
That.
It's like that, yeah. But essentially the kind of sandy dunes and scrapes just move. They kind of open up somewhere in the fairway and then they'll close and then go somewhere else. And it's all
like
moving
in 5 minutes. Like yeah. It happens over, you know, periods of weeks, periods months of and years. But,
if they get a harsh wind or something, it'll just blow a load of this sand away and then onto a different bit. And
but whereas Kenema, you were like playing sort of off to the right, north, south, east and west here, but beyond the boundaries of the course at Kenema, you've got the racetrack where I think they have the Grand Prix and stuff, and you've got you got apartments, you got houses, you're aware you're around some conurbation. But if you drop a random street viewer into Noordwijk Golf Club and give them 30 seconds to work it out on TikTok as to where they are, they ain't finding it. Like, you could have been anywhere. You could have been absolutely anywhere. There's nothing to see apart from that quite anonymous sort of, was it like a TV tower or like a radio
something
master
there, like,
something
yeah.
to, from the like, Soviet era or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, Soviet era. Was it like a UN? NATO. It was a NATO command post or something crazy.
And that's the only thing you can see.
And
the landscape is utterly, utterly crazy. Now, bearing in mind, we've had a few people that have talked to us about Noordwijk before. Previous guest of the podcast, David Davis, who's a member there. The land there is revered in the Netherlands as the greatest golfing land. That possibly doesn't make the most of the land they have there. I think that's generally how...
Yeah, that would be the consensus.
Yeah, unanimous view on that. But bloody hell, the land is good.
And again, lucky enough to play
with
Martin.
But it's land they can't use. Like the land that's just beyond... So like you mentioned earlier, Noordwijk, you can kind of hear the sea. You can't literally, but you are a stone's throw from it. But it's all shielded by massive dunes. And the bit between the clubhouse and the massive dunes is there must be like hundreds of acres of just like...
You could put 10 or 12 golf courses down there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they can't touch
but
it.
But you actually can't because of the environmental legislation, which you mentioned earlier.
And it's not just it's also really, I think they've got, you know, they've got all sorts of different indigenous species in there, which some of you know, it's probably about 1,000 different species of bat. Amazingly, buckthorn, which is just an absolute weed in this country. Like you cut that stuff back. You want it off the golf course. They can't even cut clumps of buckthorn there. They've got, you know, there's...
Well, they have a kind of quid pro quo arrangement, don't they? Where it's like, if you're going to take out a clump of buckthorn, you've got to put in something else that's like biodiverse and going to promote the flora and fauna.
Yeah, so Tesla charging ports.
But it was interesting. Martin, our host, was saying that...
Bit of intro on him, please. Martin Del Fortry, another sterling bloke.
Great looking guy, good golfer. just like, just
looks
on.
20 years younger than he is.
Yeah. Tall as well, 6 foot, funny enough.
But he was our host. He was showing us around and he was saying it's quite contrary to what we get because we consider buckthorn a weed. They need it for the biodiversity. We in the UK generally like to have marum grass. Marum grass is a grass which supports duneland, so you can use it to reinforce duneland, and it also is transportable, so you can put it in and it can help the structure.
Someone's
of dunes
been doing
stuff.
Their entry level exams for agronomy or something. Have you taken up an internship with
Tom McLaughlin? Just really, yeah, Tom McLaughlin. In
you can in, apparently you can transport marum grass, where you can't do that with many other grasses.
Interesting.
Let's get James Bledge on. You'll fix all this.
Okay,
anyway.
But
anyway,
do you get in it?
But they think marum grass is a pest. So they try and get rid of it. It's something they don't want there because it's not indigenous and it doesn't help with the biodiversity. So it's kind of like the complete opposite of how we do things.
Sorry, they see it as a pest in the Netherlands.
Yeah, it wasn't. Well, Martin was telling me that it's not native to the area.
Why do they want to protect it then?
No, they're protecting the buckthorn. And they're trying to get rid of the marum.
Sorry,
the opposite.
That was my absolute ignorance there.
Now, the other thing that was explained to me about Noordwijk was that it had shades of Formby, in so much as there's pure lynx holes, and then you go through periods where you go in and out of the trees at the top. So it's like sort of pine trees. And I think that's a fair assessment in terms of that's a very noticeable characteristic of Formby, and it's noticeable for Noordwijk. the stuff up there is like way up the top, and you kind of have to, as the course is rooted, Noordwijk is the only one that's not a cult course, therefore it's not sort of just been iterated around a sort of golden age layout. It is a much more recent layout.
60s,
you did tell me cult laid out a course at Noordwijk.
I'm pretty certain.
And I said
two kilometres up the road.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, and then they had to sell it to
park. You weren't listening to our host.
I think I was hitting that scalding hot 8-iron out on the side of 8 or sort of 6 or wherever it was at the time. But yeah. So
everyone's just seen that strike. I think there. Well, actually, there was a Noordwijk course that was built by Harry.
Not has everyone just seen that?
Did everyone see that shot I've just hit?
Yeah. So it was a couple of miles down the road. They sold it for apartment land, and they with the money, they raised, they moved to where they are now.
So Noordwijk is the most recently built on Linksland in the Netherlands, and probably will probably remain that way for a long time, would be my guess, even though you could put about 30 courses next door. Now,
I heard Donald Trump's going to come in and just try and do some sort of agreement with the local
even
government.
He wouldn't get it done. I mean, look, I'm dancing around this topic here. It is a newer routing, therefore you kind of go through, I would say the challenges of that are you go away from the house and go right up to the top and then work your way back down after 9, and then you repeat that same exercise again. And I think partly where the feeling of like it felt like quite a long walk. It was the second round of the day, and you have to, it's quite tricky land to try to scale, isn't it? That sort of out and back twice.
It's out and back and out and up.
Yeah. It's kind of crazy tough.
Say the 5th and probably the 13th are probably like the highest points on the course.
Yeah.
And that created for me like a few like feelings of like fatigue. You've got cameras, you've got 14 clubs. It was like, oh god, you're playing back again, most stuff's long. But I think the quality I'd look at it that was the greatest was like the individual merit of each of the golf holes, but because of some of the walking and some of the walks between the holes broke that up. When I look back at it in hindsight, I'm like, yeah, the quality of the individual golf holes is extremely high.
Yeah, it just didn't flow, which quite as well as somewhere like a Dapan or a Kenemare even. And I think that's something that you just see quite commonly with more recently built courses, is that the focus is on, can I make the best 18 individual holes? Maybe less time on the flow of it. But that is something that, as far as we're aware, you know,
the club are aware of,
you know, they've got a master plan. If they can get things through with the environment agency and local government, and the work they're doing with Mackenzie and Ebert, they've got some really exciting plans on as far as the routing's concerned.
It's a great golf course today.
Great potential.
But if they can execute like the plans that they want to do and really kind of do that. Now to do that there does require, I think, a lot of consultation with environmental groups, people on sustainability committee, governments, you know, and when you play with Martin, you realize just the sheer passion, love, intensity for the place, for the local environment, for the stuff, you know. He's like, I pretty much spend all Friday here and I meet with different ecologists and we work through exactly how we're going to do things right down to like a molecular level with that golf course on a bloody big site. It's like,
with 1,400 members as well.
Noordwijk is seriously lucky to have people like Ingeborg, who we met afterwards, the club manager, like we're going to talk about her, I'm sure. But yeah, and Martin, you're like, wow, that's really impressive. And we met Richard as well, course manager from...
Yeah, Richard Wing. Shout out to him.
Where's he from? He's like Lake
Sheffield.
Street. Sheffield, that's it. Yeah, crazy.
He watched the skankiest par of mine up 9 I think I've ever had. That was into wind, that par 5, where I basically duffed a driver off the deck, hit a driver off the deck to within 20 foot short, and then lagged it to about a foot, tapped in the par. Disgusting.
That hole into that wind, though, felt like about as long as a fortnight, didn't it? I think some of the golf holes, though, are just serious bangers. Like, you get a pretty good sense for it. But I think the first 3 holes kind of capture, for me, everything that you kind of get from Noordwijk in the last 15 in some ways. So, you know, one's this like quirky short 4 where for some absurd reason you've got a driving range which is just beyond the landing zone for your driver.
In the driving zone, yeah.
It's a pretty nice golf hole. But it's like, you know, you're like, oh, crikey, yeah, I can see like maybe there's going to be some work that they do. That's like hole 1 is like, oh, okay, maybe they're going to
move the driving range.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, or, you know, you just get the sense that they're like, oh, there's a few little routing things here that they're going to think about. Then you play hole 2 and you're like, bloody hell, this land is about as crazy as I've ever seen. Like, you play this long par five, stretches out from the dunes where you tee off, you know, you can
felt
see.
Felt like a journey, didn't it? You felt like you were going on a journey on that hole. Like,
you've got to hit two really good shots to kind of be at the apex
just
of the
scale
hill.
That huge
and then
dune.
You kind of got another little valley you got to get through to the green.
The green and everything. So all of that there was like, my God, the land is magnificent, the natural landscape. And that hole as well, I felt, showed off as much of the brilliant landscape that you could see. You could look back at the clubhouse. You could see out into the distance. And then for me, hole three was just a brilliant par three, where you could see some of the push-up green stuff that they've done. So when they built some of that, I think they had the Great Linksland, that's this huge rolling terrain, and then they sort of like pushed up sort of heavier earth into some of the green sites. You've got that massive contouring within the middle of the green, which is quite a big feature. I'd say the boldness of those greens was pretty severe. So what I mean? Like those three.
Yeah, they
but
capture
I,
well.
Good and bad,
I'd probably
good
extend
bad
that for one more hole, actually. Because then if you go on to four... I'm not going to do this for the whole round. But then four is the first one you get through the pine trees. You know, you play that uphill par four, which sort of doglegs right. And then you've, you know. And
trees on the right.
For those four, you're like, yeah, okay, I think I've seen
all in on this,
a lot of the variants you're going to get. At
by the fifth tee, you've got a flavour of exactly what's to come for the rest of the round. You've got like, and just to think about that, four holes, you've been exposed to a hell of a lot there quite quickly.
Yeah, it's a lot of variance.
It's a massive, massive assault to the century.
Definitely the
system.
Windiest we played as well. I mean, the third hole in particular, when that pin was shoved over on the right, just on a sort of kind of little precipice where the slopes either side that funnel the ball away from the green, or off the green, I should say. And we had the wind coming in off the right. So it's asking you to try and hit something left to right to try and hold it up or start something over the crap on the right. It was good playing it in proper linksy conditions.
It was the most linksy course I think we played in terms of the thing. But should we talk about the bad day the greenkeeper must have had?
Well, I was thinking in my head the pins, because that par three was again an early introduction. It was up on that precipice, and I went about 20 feet long. I gave it a good rap, that putt, so I was to blame. But then you had a pretty good putt, Tom, and you were like nowhere to be seen. And then only when I had the return one, I was like, you could be here for a week and you could not hole out on this green. Like, this pin is a joke.
I parred that hole.
Some of those.
We didn't take that out with Richard Wing, though, did we?
Filth. No. We've been too polite at that stage. I think me also topping the driver on the ninth.
16 and 17 were the most barbaric. We hadn't seen those by the time we saw him. But
17 was a joke, actually.
17 is the worst pin I have ever seen in my life. I've never done one of those
fun.
Greenkeeper revenge days.
It wasn't
days.
Bad. It was just
well, you
fun.
Didn't have to hit the putt, that's why.
But have you seen those greenkeeper revenge things they do where they'll go out and they'll put like sand rakes and stuff around the pin and stuff at certain clubs? I've never played in one of those, but
so for context,
the pin at 17 would qualify.
We played a good little match, didn't we? We kind of got into a rhythm of playing foursomes from probably 10 onwards or so, maybe 11 onwards. Sam and I playing against Martin, our host, and Tom. And it was good. Like, it was a close match, back and forth. There wasn't much in it. And I think we got to the 17th hole, one down. And obviously, it's a long par three, probably playing about 190 yards into the teeth with a big fall off slope to the right.
Uphill,
yeah, tiny bit uphill. I think we had the honour. I did like a really
shot.
Solid 5-iron. That sort of started left of the green, didn't want to go anywhere near that pin. Center of the green, just kind of trundled off a little bit left half, 35 feet away or something like that. And Sam's got over this putt, and the pin is cut probably
no more than 2 feet
to 3 feet away from a slope.
The false front,
yeah. The false
20
front
feet.
Is like 20 feet, runs down 20 feet below the level of the green, and funnels the ball off another 10 yards. 15 yards away from the green. And that's where I think Martin missed it. Did you putt it up from there?
I putt it up from down there.
You putted it up from there to like 15 feet, which is an amazing putt. You've like taken a full swing with a putter and managed to get it up to 15 feet. And Sam's just looking over this 35, 40 footage, just
but if
breathing
you were
on it.
2 feet beyond, even a foot beyond that pin,
it's off.
You're 20 yards away.
Yeah.
This thing's not got like 10 feet in the hole, has it?
We just couldn't get back at you. It turned out that Martin's pretty much the most celebrated Dutch amateur golfer as well in the country's history as well.
Just behind Barron.
Yeah. So it's like we're clipping our way through. We're ticking off elite Dutch amateurs. Not courses here. We're ticking off elite amateurs. I Nordvik was just such a heavy walk that I think after a round in the morning and being like the fourth day now of the tour, like our listeners to this podcast are probably by now, feeling somewhat lethargic, you know? Feeling like, okay.
Hopefully this is a two-parter, otherwise they're broke.
It's got to be a two-parter, this, otherwise only, I think, about 100,000 bands would actually get through this long now. It was crazy. So it was a real tough walking course. But
and then the spread.
Great little spread after. Got to meet Ingeborg, did we? The club manager. Mm. And spend a bit more time with her and Martin.
She was a fierce character.
Great, some great bits of Marlin.
Official.
Yeah.
And the tour.
Rules official of the European tour.
What was the story? She called a...
Yeah, we're not going to tell the story though, because I think that there was an outcome that wasn't so favourable. But she had some great stories about rules
official. If you want to hear that story, go and play Nordvik and go and speak to Ingeborg, because there's a cool rules story there, which we're not going to betray confidence live on air.
I really liked the clubhouse at Nordvik because it was more modern.
Like beach housey kind of vibe.
Yeah, exactly, like a beach shack. And it had that like upstairs lounge with these like really cool, like, patterned, you know, big bold white and blue stripes sort of deck chair. Well, not deck chairs, but like patio area outside. I was like, this is big, lovely up here.
Big panoramic glass. Oh, and because the sun was setting over the sea, it was just like, oh, very cool place.
Beautiful.
Very cool.
I really enjoyed Nordvik. But, you know, it's like I said with the Kenema stuff, with hindsight, to me, it wouldn't have mattered playing Kenema or Nordvik, but I felt like actually we pushed too much into the itinerary. If there's a recommendation from this pod, it's 100% to go and tour in Holland. Like, you've got to do it.
Do one a day though.
But don't replicate that. If
unless
someone
you
wants
go in
to
the
take
summer.
Yeah, maybe perhaps. If you go in the summer. But even then, I think you'd be fatigued and you'd want to do 27 at Kenema, and you might just want to hang at Nordvik. Mm. You might want to just, you know, kind of go out and play a few holes under some sunset or whatever. I just wouldn't do them both in a day.
I actually don't think you can go too far wrong with whichever one you picked either.
No, not at all. That's like, what I'm saying.
Like,
if that was a four-course trip, we'd still be waxing lyrical.
Yeah.
And what you have to make sure you do, because the other thing that will be on your mind is going to The Hague and actually soaking up some of the great culture and food and bars that's available at these incredible cities. I mean, The Hague was just incredible, wasn't it? Yeah. When we haven't got to the golf course yet, but seeing as we've gone into painstaking detail and everything that we've drunk and eaten on this trip, it would be rude to not mention the meal that we had or the evening we had with Willem at The Hague after Nordvik. So I think we left there around about 5:45, 6 o'clock, something like that.
Yeah,
maybe
we got away
at
a reasonable time because of the line stuff. But then went in like half an hour, I think, into Den Haag.
Checked into
pitched
the hotel.
Up a nice hotel. Yeah. You faffed around, did your usual thing, rung everyone in your phone book for 20 minutes. We stood outside waiting. We all pretended it was a joke. And then I eventually had to go inside and ring your room and say, Bruce, this is a bit rude. And then we came and met Willem. And we had a Willem again, just lovely, straight in, lovely continental vibe, cobbled streets, people sat outside. You know, just every bistro is packed. You're like,
I wouldn't call it a bistro. Is bistro the right?
Well, no, it's more
nomenclature. It was more tapas-y, wasn't it? This place, bistro is the only thing that's coming to mind.
Bistro, right? But it was I thought Madeleine's was a great meal.
Bistro is French as
an
well.
An evening in Den Haag. I mean, look, we're going to talk about food and stuff, but like sitting down, and Willem gave us a load on like Dutch custom, didn't he? Just customs and like cultural stuff.
Yeah.
And then took us for a tour, like a walking tour around the city.
Oh, after the meal.
Yeah.
Yeah, I vividly remember Sam just saying, this is just another great city. I'll tell you what, lads, this is where the UK has just fucked it with like globalisation and like the loss of the high street. It's such a shame.
It's totally lost. Willem took us round Den Haag. He's like, we'll go for a little walk. So he walked out to this square, like I think it's called like the French Park or something like that, or the French Street, because it's got shades of like a sort of Parisian walkway. And before we sort of went over and sort of walked around some of the canals and stuff, and you look at it and you're like, there's some lovely government buildings there, but there's nice independent stuff, independent restaurants. You're like, if this was in Britain, I'd just be staring at yet another fucking Primark. And it was like, oh, you know, do you know what? Thank God, you know, that they've not, you know, done that here. It was just and also there's a reflection on people that want to kind of give you a walking tour and show you around the city. If someone came to Birmingham, I would just try and get a stab proof vest on them and get them out of there as fast as I could. It's like, you know, he's like, no.
Do you want to come and play at Blackwell? We'll go into Birmingham as well for a little cultural tour.
Do you know what? Some people
after.
Did that recently at the foursomes, didn't they? They were like, joking. Oh, we're going to go out in Birmingham. And it's like, you've lost the bloody plot. Just get back to the Premier Inn, get your head down 6 hours and we'll go it again.
Yeah, but double bolt the door and drive.
But Den Haag, beautiful.
We did have a gorgeous meal. And I suppose one of the highlights of the evening for me was after we had our meal, Willem was quite keen to show us the walking tour and we go get another beer. And you know when you walk into a pub and you absolutely know you shouldn't be there, but you're already in by that point. So you're like, well, I'm committed. I'm going to look like an idiot if I turn down. When you walk into a pub that's solely inhabited by people that are at least half your age in fancy dress, that was a big one for me.
They were all wearing togas, weren't they?
Yeah, we got kicked out. He was taking us there. He was like, it's a great place. I think it's because it was on the canal or something. But it was like, no, you're not coming in.
Yeah, four blokes in golf quarter zips.
Through the door. Yeah. I was stood in there. I was like, yeah, I think there's something wrong here.
I just remember that being a lovely, nice evening. I thought the food that we had there that was just like knockout. Like, I don't eat sashimi. That's not go-to for me on the menu. And I was like, bloody hell. This had so much of it.
I think you had mercury poisoning when you played the next day, didn't you?
That and gout really impaired my performance at that.
Maybe they offset one another. That might have been it.
But then we stayed at this place, Vassa. It's not Vassa.
Vandervalk, wasn't it?
Vandervalk in Vossmer. Vossmer was the area, which is just outside Den Haag. So if you are going there and playing Den Haag, it is the perfect place to stay because... You know, it was literally 5 minutes in the car in the morning and it was a dead easy blitz into there. So just a bit of helpful travel tip. Next morning at Royal Hague.
Is it Royal Hague or is it...
Well...
Koninklijke.
Koninklijke. Koninklijke. Koninklijke. Koninklijke. Hagish. So the nomenclature...
I mean, he is going to move out there, isn't he?
Sound like he pulled out of that one, didn't he?
Hagish. No, so we should cover the nomenclature, to use your phrase, Bruce, around... Because all these places have... S-C-H-E on the end of their names. And Willem was one over dinner. Can you remember? You're better on this explanation, I think.
No, I can't remember this bit.
You can't?
Can't just tell me I can. I can't.
So I think he said something like, previously in Dutch language, the S-C-H-E on the end of everything basically was to say of somewhere. Mm-hmm. So it was like Koninklijke, which that's has just got bit. Way too many K's and consonants in there to actually spell, is essentially Royal of The Hague. So the S-C-H-E at the end of these things, which has it in Eindhoven, Utrecht have it, Kennemer don't, Noordwijk I think do on one of the spellings I've seen. It's basically sort of that. Spelling, so you've got Koninklijke Hagish, which is basically Royal Hague. I think that works.
Absolutely.
Now I've got through that. Can I have a 10 minutes breather while you two go at it?
Blowing place.
Royal Hague, yeah. I don't think I can say I've been on golfing land like that. It is bonkers.
If Kennemer was full of drama, it like took all that drama and put it on roids. And then made you walk.
There's no comparison. So, like, you could make a reachy example with Kennemer, or you know what I mean? Or you could, yeah. I mean, this is the oldest Dutch club, but I think, you know, the cult layout there must have been sort of moved around a bit because it's like there is flamboyance and there's flair. And then this was just downright like. We've got to try and put some words around this because we're sort of just. You know,
yeah,
stretching for hyperbole. I've never played a golf course that's any. I've got no reference point to The Hague. This is good and bad, but like I
would say,
I don't have any reference point to it.
A reference point I would say for The Hague, in terms of to describe how you would walk it, would be, I would say shades of like, and you're going to laugh, but like of a Painswick, or a Cleve, or a Kington. That it felt like you were on a mountaintop course.
In the pod.
No, but there was such enormous undulation.
But stretched out.
But not over a mountain. Mm. It was just within the hole. So like, it felt like I should have been at the top of a mountain by the end of it. But I was just where I started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're not going to get many even lies. Or any even lies or flat lies. You're almost just playing...
I mean,
across massive caverns, and then descend and then summit to another reasonably flat area, and it's just
it's classified as a lynx. I wouldn't say it has. There's some dunes and stuff, and you do definitely encounter bits of that land, but it's so far from being anything that you would normally describe as a lynx course.
If you looked at East Coast Scottish lynx courses, it's world
incomparable.
Apart.
Yeah.
And I said, like, the first hole, just to give an example of species, what mate. I'm trying to try and say really, apparently really poorly, but I would say the first hole is kind of it's a short par five, but it's the long hole straight down. You must drop 25 to 30 meters, roughly. Mm. Elevation change from tee to green. And the second hole is almost the complete reverse of that, where you basically scale back up that, so you're back where you start.
But you almost go 50 meters down, then 50 meters up, then another 30 meters up.
Because there's this huge collection area.
Yeah.
So, and then, then the third hole, which you then kind of, where you just started on the first, there's a tee box there. You play to a green, which is probably 5 or 10 meters above you, but you've got to go over a huge valley, like massive valley. You have to walk, and you play to a little bit below you,
and then you
play back up the hill,
and then four is 220 plunging downhill.
Another enormous drop downhill, and it's just like the most severe topography. I don't think it would be possible to route a golf course now on anything that's more undulating than that.
Well, yeah, let's dive into the history, because it is quite an interesting one, really. I think although the Koninklijke Haagse, however you want to pronounce it, Royal Hague Golf Club was founded back in the last decade of the 19th century, they weren't playing golf on that site. They were playing golf, I think, probably somewhere else around The Hague. And that site was actually built by Colt, Allison and Morrison in the 30s, I believe, for a Jewish businessman, very, very successful, wealthy man. That clubhouse, I believe, was his country home. Or maybe it was just his actual home, I'm not quite sure. And he then fled the Netherlands, I think, presumably, sense of foreboding about maybe the coming sort of Nazi occupation and so on. And then Royal Hague Golf Club took over the course that had been laid out, I think mostly by Allison. I think Holt and Allison were working together at that time, but
it was
that's
a later
essentially
one
the history
Allison,
of it. Yeah.
It's like Morrison was doing a lot of the work as well. So they had
they refined
Morrison
it a bit
and
more.
Allison were helping Colton, I think, particularly with the last stages of Colt's career. Like, I mean, he's not traveling to the Netherlands.
No, he's not.
He's not getting KLM refunds every 15 minutes, is it? It's an incredible story. It's an amazing story.
Willem took us up. Into it wasn't an archive room, but there was a room with lots of archive photographs that we looked at after the round. And it Royal Hague now is very green. Mm. It's perfectly manicured. It's probably the most manicured the courses we played, I would say.
And all the surrounding was verdant.
Yeah, yeah.
There were dunes around and stuff.
But they were all very
green.
But
they were grass covered. They were verdant.
Yeah.
You know?
Whereas you look back at these old photographs of some of these holes, and it looked exactly how Nordvik looked, which was broken ground.
Only more sand. Only more
like,
of the
it's
stuff.
It's almost like it was just little patches of grass they put greens, and patches of grass they put tees. And it was like, it looked like islands of grass, whereas it's obviously changed a lot over the years. But it did have a very Nordvik feel originally.
And Richard, who was with us, gave a quite a protracted story, I felt, about some changing the atmosphere to do with cows and all sorts of stuff. I'm not even going to try to have a
chemical engineer. He's bright bloke,
yeah,
Richard White.
Yeah, he had an IQ of about 400. I mean, I was just, I wasn't following it, you know, but he did steer me well on not having the meatballs for lunch, which is like a Dutch specialty, which he just said, he was English as well.
That
Richard.
Was the tip
and
of the
talk.
Like, Scottish, actually. He'd hate to be referred to as English. So, Richard, if you are listening to this, I'd like, you know, I've managed to correct Sam's ignorance there.
We will 100% edit that one. No, Richard is, Richard's a Scotsman, it's a slip of the tongue. He knew that was not going to be the ticket for me and steered me well. But he gave some explanation about it. When you looked at those photos, though, the holes looked almost unrecognizable. Fourth, playing downhill, just the most long, long drop shot three that you could imagine.
With sand everywhere, wasn't it?
He's just like, it must have been contender for the best hole in the bloody world.
This was the era of Hickory clubs as well, you know. This hole's like 230 yards.
Oh, you're going to plug a sort of cleek in the face of a bunker and then try and get some spoonie on the back of it. It's like, how on earth is that?
I think you've got a...
Is a cleek of sort of wood? Yeah.
Cleek's a long iron.
Not bad. We'll edit that out.
No, we won't actually. So I think we should try and just talk about some of the holes to try and bring this to life. Because I think one and two is fine enough. But I think if you looked at holes like, I'm going to say like 6, 7, 8, and 9 has been a fairly good epitome of the Hague. Wild elevation change. Unbelievably challenging. Certainly we were playing from the back tees again, which was... You know, it's a long course off the backs anyway, but coupled with elevation change means it plays significantly further than the yardage does.
There's a few banked fairways as well, aren't there?
Banked fairways, ball runs out. There's huge fronts to the greens and huge runoffs. Like as big as some of the ones at Noordwijk, it really demanding. Like I remember hitting shots that were of the finest order that I can hit the golf ball, and I couldn't get on putting surfaces for holes on the run. And I was like,
that was like the best you hit it all tour.
100% was the best. Like I probably posted a half decent number at Eindhoven, but Hague, I was like, I think I would have been fighting to break mid 80s. Like, but I probably shot 71.
I actually shot 79 because I cancelled it all up.
I remember hitting shots and just thinking, Jesus, this is penal. This is really tough. Like, you've got to be on your game.
We were stood on the fourth tee, in fact, with our host Willem, and we were talking about the choice of tees and how it, you know, you can go back quite a bit on some of these white tees. And he said, "Yeah, you know, I play off three. Off the yellow course, I get 4 shots. Off the white course, I get 10." I was like, Christ. Yeah. Like, he's like, yeah, it's like 6 shots difference for me. Plays off like a WHS of 3.
So it's tough.
Yeah.
But then where do you go beyond tough? Well, you know, we've already said monster elevation change. I'd say the greens are, you know, if Eindhoven have these wonderfully understated, charming cult green sites, Hague has these kind of, they're almost on steroids, you know. They are so beefed up with the runoffs, and it's so potent.
Yeah,
it's like if we played that first, it would have been almost over facing playing Will Hague.
I think there were in the Hague. It was definitely a course that you had to know before you played it. There were bits of the greens that you had to go for, and there were bits of the fairways you had to go for. You could be on the fairway but on the wrong side, completely like no shot. Or, you know, you could put yourself in onto a green that, I mean, there was a couple of greens that you got on, I think 10, 11 might have been one of them, that par 4 that you got on, is like, it's a mathematical impossibility to 2-putt from here.
There were quite a few spots where you missed it, and like I was playing with Willem's brother, Peter.
Another bloody good player.
Yeah, like didn't tell me, but I kind of clocked onto it, and he was wearing like a NGF logo top, like Netherlands Golf Federation or something. But turned out to be a highly decorated sort of senior amateur champion or Netherlands golf team member.
And he was tall and quite good looking from memory as well.
Yeah, surprise, shock.
As was Willem.
And Richard as well.
Richard was the shortest man. Great, the whole tour is 5'10".
Well, no, he was like 6'2", I think, as well. Yeah,
okay, I've done him twice there.
Sorry,
was
Richard.
He 6'2"?
Yeah, he was. Yeah. So Richard was not only Scottish, he was also comfortably over 6 foot. But, you know, other than insulting him in those two ways, Sam, he was also a great player too.
He was definitely a great player.
Yeah, really, but they said that, like, on a couple of cases, they're like, yeah, we just don't see people get up and down from that spot very often at all. Like, you know, that runoff there, you'd be better off rather than flirting with them, because there's a few pins that give you an insight into, like, if you're trying to take on a pin that looks fairly benign from back in the fairway, you get up there and they'd be like, no, this is left side of the green, or even just bail out a little bit left all day because there's a much easier up and down from there. It felt, you know, because I'm conscious we sort of said, oh, it's crazy, it's like golfing
around
we've never seen before. We've got to bring
holes.
It to life a
so
little
six,
bit.
And, I mean, six we played from the absolute tippy tips, and that was, you know, I hope you've got some drone footage. It has the most spectacular golf hole. And it's one of those where when the strength of the hole is in the tee to green, you know, the last thing you're thinking when you've button driver four iron pin high is like, oh my God, we've got an enormously dramatic green side where I'm pin high and I've got nearly no chance of a four still here. You know, Willem's openly saying, this is really a five. Everyone plays it as a five, to be fair. Then there was quite a bit of not seeing your ball finish. There wasn't many blind drives, but then seven's that kind of...
Seven
was a great driving hole over this dune and the post. Mm.
And you could go down six if you wanted to. Like, that's something because I was kind of droning around that time, and you could see that six and seven were very, very generous, actually. But you just can't see that from the tee. Like, they've got kind of a connected fairway. And they kind of come back on themselves. So it's one of those really good things you get in architecture where it's very deceptive from the tee.
Yeah.
You're like, I can't.
But it's not strategic because, you know, it's definitely penal. Like, you know, that hole is you've got to step up and execute a really good drive over a very long way to get over the
but
dune.
But that's because of the yardage. Like, yeah. If we'd have played it further forward, it would have become more strategic.
I agree. You look at the makeup of the green then. You had that quite severe bank left. You've got this little plectrum of doom thing going on short left. And off the back right of the green, you disappear into the complete abyss. Like, it really is demanding shot qualities of the highest order. Someone, I'm pretty sure when we played Willems, you know, he said somebody had shot 65 around there or something off the backs recently, which... There was no wind when we played it, and I got the sense they could tuck the pins much harder if they tried. So 65 on any day there off the backs is a performance of a different order.
And I thought,
but you know what I liked about it, though, is we had a friend who went out and played all of these courses, actually, for a few weeks before, a couple of months before we went out, and he sort of said, yeah, hey, quite an exacting test, maybe a touch too penal for his liking. And I was kind of expecting that maybe going in, and I thought it was demanding, but actually I felt that it was pretty generous in places, or for the most part off the tee.
I agree.
And then the sort of demanding nature of it was the approach shots.
Yes.
I hate the expression, it's a second shot golf course, but it kind of is true with somewhere like The Hague, where if you could miss it in the right spots, you could make a decent score around there. It was just like you could have runoffs, and you weren't losing your ball and stuff like that, but you hit runoff areas around by the green where you just weren't getting it up and down. If you're getting too cute, you could make a double. And I think that's a pretty playable golf course. It's difficult to score around, but at least you're in the hole.
Yeah.
You're in the hole, and you'll make yourself look like a bit of an idiot up by the green. There were a couple of holes on the back nine, maybe 14 and 15,
yeah, 14,
which were
15
probably
were
tighter.
Like, you're right in it, yeah.
Where it's like,
and
you 16 do actually
again, you could make an
it.
Idiot of yourself,
yeah.
But that was the short
15
four.
Was a stunning goal.
And at 18 actually was
well,
a,
we're going to park 18 for a second because we're going to get there. But yeah,
yeah.
I
think, you know, I really enjoyed it because, you know, as I mentioned earlier, playing with Peter, like Dutch champion or kind of in the Dutch senior team, really, really competitive player. And then Rich as well, you know, really solid. Two handicap, I think he said he was. Look better than that. He was, you know, rips it on the way around. And they were like, right, we're going to play 4-2-0. I'll have a good competitive game. And so, actually, that was probably one of the rounds in the trip where I kind of like focused in and was like, right, I'm going to just try and, you know, put together a score here and give these guys a half decent game. And The Hague is almost like the perfect examination of that in a way.
I think it was hands down the most difficult golf course we played.
Right. Yes,
I would say The Hague was
very few easy. Like, if you take a hole that I suppose on, you know, just sheer difficulty ranking, I'm not going to say stroke index, but you know, if you rank the difficulty of it, I would say 13 is a moderate hole at The Hague. It's certainly by no means one of the toughest, possibly one of the easier ones out of all of them. And you looked at where they could put the pin, and we walked past it when we played the 11th, and Willem said, oh, good, I'm glad they got the pin there. He says, God, when they put it at the back, I mean, it's playing at between a half a shot and a shot harder. I sort of, bollocks. I mean, it's 20 yards. Like, can't be any different. You get up on the green, you realise it's about 4 yards wide, and there is a ridge that's about an inch wide. Otherwise, even if you're putting from the front of the green, you are totally and utterly snookered. Like, it is penal round the greens, but I would agree to you, to your point, and you're spot on, because when you say penal, you think, oh God, am I going to be walking golf holes if I'm not driving it like Rahm that day or whatever? You're definitely not. You're not losing golf balls. Yeah, and it is for giving off the tee.
I can attest to that, because this was sixth round of tour, if we include Rye, and my swing was held together by sellotape by that point.
you were mutilated. You weren't mutilating the golf ball. You were being mutilated.
Yeah, I was absolutely, the swing just absolutely
loose. It had gone at that point.
Yeah. And like, I just couldn't keep the ball on the planet, but I didn't. The only ball I lost, weirdly, was when I flushed one pin high left on seven, I think it was, and it literally just vanished.
Yeah, it was the best shot you hit all day in this lawn you lost.
But apart from that, I played a bit like an idiot, but never really lost a ball. And like you say, when you're not hitting the ball well around there, you're just going to be showing up, I think.
I've never seen a course where you get there to that caddy hut, because the clubhouse is on the lower land, and you never really, we went straight to the caddy hut where they do little coffees and do a sandwich, and you watch people tee off, and it's the high point of the course.
This is worth painting a bit of a picture, really, is when we drive in.
So you, it's very grand drive through and everything. You got the driving sort of range and stuff there, but then you walk up this steeple and you get to this little caddy hut with a lovely little heron logo, which is, you know, part of the sort of club's identity, and it's just lovely. And you look out, and the first time, and you think, usually you can make some shapes out of the holes. Like at the very least, you look at it and go, I've got a vague idea. These holes go there and there. And, oh, I wonder when we go out there. This was an assortment of greens. And I was like, I've got no idea where those greens are played from or where. Like, it's just, and I think that'll pick it up. I bet that's in the drone footage. You can just be like, wow. Like, you'll see how bold this thing is with greens just propped up here and stuff.
I've got the perfect term for it, actually. It's not a term that I've certainly not coined.
It's not compress and releases or transitions.
No,
or...
but it is from that part of the world. Stuart McComb, Castle Stuart, little shout out to him, when he was showing us around there, negative space. Because when you get to that first tee box up by the caddy hut on the Hague, you kind of summited that path from the car park, and you look out and you're like, oh my word, as you say, Sam, you can see holes in the distance and certain green sites, but there's like crashing sort of vast expanses like below it in sort of a negative space that you're like, oh, what's down there? And there's a lot of that. You can obviously see the high points.
You should do more podcasts. Just so good when you come alive like
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely.
I wish we could get Bruce on the pod more. It really
absolutely
would be great.
Ridiculous take from me here, because this is just stupid, but I hope the point will
work. We're only 2.5 hours into the pod, so let's just go for it now.
I wonder even if you can get where I'm going with this.
I can't believe it's
first tee.
Are we going to go cross-country golf, or is that where we're going now?
First tee, shades of St. Andrew's Old. Now, in that... Well,
okay,
yes,
you've got to guard you. I mean, this is...
You've got a hill to climb here.
Yeah, you in can't that, see our reaction.
It was because, like you say, so you look down, it's not. There's no real rough to speak of in the whole golf course, really. Not like anything that's going to be a problem.
Oh, Barry, yeah.
You're looking down, you're on probably the highest point of the golf course. You've got the second holes on your right, the ninth holes on your left, and you're looking down the first. It's a really long hole, but there is literally the whole world to aim at, and it's almost like you can't pick a point. It's like, I don't know where to hit this.
I think it's a stretch.
It's an intimidating shot, because it's like, there are so many places I can go. Which one do I...
Yeah,
the danger of shoehorning these kind of takes to the back end of what will probably be quite a long podcast is that the few hardened listeners that have reached this point have now lost all respect for us. So you may have buried the joke.
No, I know what you're saying, but I'd say there's a big difference in that when you go to St. Andrews and you step on that first tee, you're like, wow, okay, there's a lot to aim at down there. Where do I kind of pick my target? But it's a dead flat piece of ground, and you know you can see the ball land, and you know you've got to keep it between, Lynx Road on the left and the beach on the right. That's,
I,
you know,
I'm going with,
but
it,
at the Hague,
almost...
it's like, I'm hitting this and I'm not going to see it land.
Yeah,
it's, and is, almost... there any, is it all right over there?
All right.
But I suppose where I'm going with it, it's almost intimidating in its generosity.
Yeah. I don't know if it's generous, because it's like the unknown. I almost think it's like you're on the moon and you're going to try and jump over the edge of it.
It felt
like
the Indiana Jones, Last Crusade thing, where he steps off the rock thing again, didn't it? It didn't feel like it felt like a pretty perilous opening tee shot. When you got down there, you're like, okay, there's a bit of room to play with here.
But
notwithstanding, we've got to talk about the 18th.
The tee shot on the 18th, because it's just got to be talked about. I mean, To give this a tiny bit of context, Sam and I played with Willem behind Bruce, Richard, and Peter. Bruce, the 17th and 18th tee boxes is kind of a weird quirk to The Hague, is they're almost right next to each other, and you play a short par three, and you kind of walk back to where you've just hit, which isn't brilliant in terms of...
But only the medal tee, though. But we were playing it at 580 yards or something.
Yeah. But... So you play this par three and you kind of walk back and then play the par five to finish. Sam had heard Bruce, so he played his tee shot and then sort of jumped across to Bruce to see him. So you'd seen the hole.
I actually found the only long grass on the course that I was wading through. So I was going to get lost in the reeds between the tees.
Yeah.
So I played the hole traditionally. Case had driven all the way up from Eindhoven just to see us on the 17th and 18th and have a spot of lunch before we left, which was incredibly thoughtful. But I saw him on the 17th green. We'd have a little chat, putt out, walk back to the 18th. And I mean, Sam's banditry of words, it's just gross most of the time. But this reveal when you stand on the 18th tee or you emerge onto the 18th tee at The Hague, I genuinely just started laughing. And I must have laughed for almost a minute.
It was weird behavior.
Because you're up there, what feels like 1,000 feet above sea level. And you're just looking out at this sliver of fairway. It's a bit more generous when you get down there, but not much. Sort of sandy scrape up the left.
Where it looks right.
Like it'll find your ball. Yeah, right just looks like the end of the world. Like there's just an infinite forest down there. And then perched up in the distance, looks like 1,000 yards away, is this amazing clubhouse, which you've not seen at that point.
You've not seen it
up until now. It's the first reveal you get of it. It's got a pretty amazing sort of symmetry to it, really, in a way. And then the sort of nice thatched roof that's the hallmark of the clubhouses in Holland. And kind of split out with the sort of terrace out the back where, or out the front, I guess, from where you're seeing it, where we ended up having lunch. And yeah, it's just
the complete opposite of the 18th hole at Prestwick, which is just a very gentle, warm down. Yeah. You know, here's a good...
Come
on in, the water's lovely. You are bruised by the time you get to the 18th tee, and it's like, your day's not done yet.
Yeah, it's just like, here it is.
And the clubhouse is like a mirage in the distance.
Yeah, you're going to come in here and have a wonderful time. Yeah, you're literally like that sort of... the pathetic sort of thirsty man in a desert, and the oasis is just a little bit out of reach, and it's like you got to just navigate this,
but it is,
and you reap the rewards.
Doubt, I have never been so breathtaken or
breathtaketh.
I've never
taketh your breath
like I've seen a more stunning golf hole.
Yeah, it's beautiful, but I think it was a brilliant fitting to the end of the tour as well. Like, it really was, wasn't it? You know,
yeah,
it's like
I'd like to argue on it, because I know you boys think it was probably overly difficult, that golf hole.
Architecturally, I thought it was quite a tricky closing hole.
A bit too penal.
Yeah, let's not forget the course is bookended with par five. So, you know, but I do think tough golf courses kind of demand a tough closing hole. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense, would it? You know, and it's, you know, it's strategic, but you know, you can get yourself into a lot of bother around there. So you're kind of expecting it to be tough as nails coming home.
It's a long par five.
It just feels very tight off the tee. I think that would be my only observation. If you have had a tough day and you've got the rights going, you know, you are just getting to the 18th thinking, I could have to walk 600 yards there.
Yeah. I my comment about it feels like fairly generous off the tee and it's penal and you look like an idiot around the greens applies. It doesn't apply as much, I'd say, to the 18th. That is pretty hard as nails as a tee. I don't know if you remember coming up to me when I was about to tee off.
You were like hyperventilating. You were like, this is really tight. This is really tight.
Really tight. Total commitment is what I said.
James Dage, total commitment.
I've got to hit this with total commitment. Yeah, just run at
God
it.
God almighty.
Slotted that drive, to be fair, though, didn't I?
But it's tough. Like, I mean, I seem to remember hitting a great drive.
You birdied it, did you, the last?
No comment. I thought he was going to give me at least a pat on the back.
He absolutely nuked it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I birdied the last. Did you birdie the last?
No. I But
we birdied the last hole of tour, didn't we, Tom?
Yeah, we did.
That's
yeah.
quality.
Unbelievable. There was a lot of birdies on that tour. Like we should add. There was a lot of birdies. There was some good golf. And there was some haulage. Drastic golf. But like, you know, it was
tour
never
golf
about
is always,
that.
Is variant.
Yeah, of course. There's crashing.
Deviant.
Crashing lows, but manic highs. A couple of threads to tie this monstrosity of a podcast to a close. That whilst we're on here, we mustn't walk by. The flow of the itinerary and how we did it. We've obviously noting the 36 hole day has been maybe a bit too much in a day. My take would be that the flow of what we did of going Eindhoven first, whether you flew in and used the travel day to drive south and do Eindhoven and then come back up and play some of the other stuff up there, or if you were driving up through the south of the country, worked well. Not for any other, yes, it was convenient, but I felt like the order we played the courses in meant there was a gentle increase in the severity and the potency of the courses. Wrong take?
Describe potency.
I'm not saying potency has been a good, like they got increasingly better, but I would say every single course we played felt more wild and dramatic than the one we'd played before.
No, yeah, I don't know if I'd agree with that, like, because I think you've got to separate out the Heathland, Eindhoven and Depan. They're very different species to the Kenema, Nordvik, Hague. I think you could, broadly speaking, those three.
I'd agree with North, that.
That's a different style of golf, and I don't know if it's a fair comparison between those and Depan and Eindhoven.
I'd agree with that, but I also think if you'd have played the Hague in this order, the Hague, Nordvik, Kenema, I don't think I would have walked away from Kenema thinking that's got loads of drama and that's really...
Yeah.
Because it does have loads of drama, but it's less undulating and severe than The Hague. Whereas I walked away from Kenema going, oh God, that's like Shades of Burke there, you know, drama and stuff. Perhaps I wouldn't have felt that if I've just seen like the Himalayas in The Hague. So perhaps completely by accident, maybe by design, that we did get it that way. But I don't think you can get it wrong.
No.
I mean,
they were so different as well. Like, I think, you know, the courses, every single one we played was, I can't stress how different they were. I really thought that Eindhoven and Depan were going to be very similar. I really thought it was going to be quite tough to see a big difference between Hague, Kenema and Nordvik. People who watch the films and the output of this tour will be like, well, now I look at that, you were mad. Well, that's obvious, but there's not that much stuff out there on these places. So I really couldn't believe the variance. And I think when you go on a tour like that, that's kind of what you want. Like,
yeah. I think we all, maybe you to a lesser extent, Sam, because you'd obviously put in a lot of the hard yards organising it and reading up on the history more so than Tom and I did prior to going on tour. But speaking for myself, I certainly felt like I went in with expectations, because how could you not, if you're interested in golf course architecture and golf course history and you want to go and you have a true passion for going to seeing these different clubs and cultures in the game and the courses and understanding how someone like Colt honed his craft and went on to build these amazing courses, or lay them out, I should say. You have expectation going somewhere like the Netherlands, because you know that you might not hear about it on Sky Sports or, you know, mainstream golf media, but if you are interested in architecture, you'll have heard about it. And yet expectations were still exceeded on every level, because that is just fundamentally the beauty of the game, isn't it, in the sport that we play. And going somewhere, I think, as well, that is a different culture. You know, the culture of the Netherlands is just very, very different to that in the UK. Even taking into account the little sort of discrepancies between England and Scotland and Ireland and so on. It was just really, really refreshing and eye-opening tour on so many levels. You know, golf, culture,
Maybe
the clubs.
Maybe want to travel to different places more with the game.
Yeah,
travel
absolutely.
To more different places.
It made me want to go see Germany.
Yeah.
I've now got a desire to go to sort of Belgium, Germany. I know, obviously, people talk about...
I'd love to go and hunt out some old stuff in Spain. You know, like you say, go and see stuff in Germany. Go and see stuff. Like, really
go to Pistrania or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, he makes you want to be like... The golf coupled with a different culture. It's just
too easy, though, isn't it? Like, you go to Scotland, you know exactly what you're getting. The history, the courses, they're all amazing. East Lothian, Fife. It's just like... You know you're in for banger after banger. It's just like, it's all there on a plate for you. Whereas I feel like you've had to put on a bit of work here. This is not like this hasn't come easy.
No, they don't really take visitors and guests. Yeah, that's not part of their operating.
We should touch on this.
This is worth covering. So all of the clubs that we've visited and as part of this film series do accept visitors. They have different rules around it. Like they'll might have limited amounts or certain days. Most of them, I think, you know, these are not places you will just book online. You will need to send an email to the secretary. You know, you will probably, you know, absolutely need to behave yourself when you're there and be respectful of,
polite.
You need to be respectful of that. You know, massively enhanced our experience being hosted by five world-class Dutch legends. But, you know, playing with local members was obviously a wonderful experience. But you've got to be mindful that these are members' clubs and they orientate themselves around the members. They are there to serve the members, which are, as you say, active and playing, and they're using the course. But they will receive them. They are not cheap to play, but they are by no means anything like the kind of the upper echelon of Scottish and Irish and open rota kind of money. They're not in the same order. So they can be done. I think it's not as user friendly as a trip because, you know, we've got to be really careful here. We've had so many great times out of Scotland, but it couldn't be further from the golf tour because you have got to do a bit more legwork on, you know, looking at cities you want to stay and thinking about the drives between, which were some of the great times as the times in the car. But I think if you've done some sampling of Scottish courses, or sampling of some Irish courses, and you feel like, or English, and you feel like, oh, well, I suppose I haven't done X, Y, and Z, and I need to tick them off. That probably tells you now there's time to start looking at somewhere different, be it going and playing a ton of stuff in France or, you know, how I'll say, like, you know, stuff like, you know, the interesting travel stuff that Noel Lang Up have done with the Sweden and Denmark trip and stuff, or the Dutch stuff. You know, it's like, you know, broaden the horizons a little bit. It doesn't mean you've got to go and tee up a ball on the, you know, the North Pole or anything stupid. You know, there's grades of this, but
and it's quite close by. It's pretty convenient to get to.
It's absurd.
If you weren't traveling,
we decided
a
week and a half beforehand that we were going to totally change our travel plans and go by car. Turned out to be the best decision we probably could have made of the whole tour.
Because we had shitloads of camera
gear. If you weren't traveling, if we just had
a nodder with your golf clubs in, you'd laugh.
Like a 45-minute flight from the UK or whatever it is. And it's like, you can get an overnight ferry from Newcastle or I think like Norwich or Ipswich. One of those has got an overnight ferry where you can just get there. Brilliant. I've got a cabin, lob in there, sleep on by there.
Get your head down,
I'm basically in Kenema. It's like...
Such nice people as well. And then that, so you know, afraid. Yeah. I'm hoping it comes through because I feel like I need to explicitly say how lucky I'd feel to have done what we've done.
Absolutely.
You know, we are absolutely blessed, and you know, really hope everyone enjoys the content that comes
hashtag
off the back
blessed.
Of this. No, we are. You know, it's a dreadful choice of words by me, but they're nice people. Very interesting what Willem said to us at dinner when he was like, "Well, you know, in terms of proximity, we're so close to Belgium. Like, I mean, it's almost impossible to sort of." Divide, you know, to tell the line geographically. But he said culturally, you know, we're miles apart from the Belgian lot, actually, in terms of the humour and some of the interpersonal stuff. And they see there's a massive affinity with the Brits because there is a dry, sarcastic tone to the humour. So stuff just seems to just gel well, you know? Like whenever I've been to Holland, Netherlands, whatever, it always just feel like you're accumulating friends.
Well, they all speak like better English than we do as well.
Way better.
So you just turn up anywhere, and whether it's the guys come and helped us like replace the tire in Utrecht, or you know, some of the students who work behind the bar there,
even the guy
or,
who wouldn't check the tire stock.
Yeah,
you know,
they all
spoke brilliant English when he wasn't prepared to help me.
Yeah.
And I kind of liked it. I had a lot of respect for that.
And Willem had a great point, didn't he? He said, "Yeah, you know, obviously there's some sort of cultural affinity with the Brits and." But even so, you know, I've got this sort of like little translation in my head of what a Brit says and what they actually mean. And, you know, I know if I'm telling a story and I have a kind of British audience and someone there just says, "Oh, that's really interesting, Willem. That's really interesting." I know what that actually means is stop fucking telling this story. It's really not that interesting. And let's change the conversation. And they're quite direct, I think.
They're binary.
Yeah, well, Peter was saying, wasn't he? He said they've got this list of things where they've got what a British person says, what a British person means, and what a Dutch person thinks they mean. And I think that was the...
Yeah.
That's interesting. What a British person says, that's interesting. what a British person means is shut the fuck up. But what a Dutch person hears is, oh, that's really interesting. I'll carry on.
I'll keep going. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, so they have to check on. Themselves. Yeah, now.
But also, they don't pussyfoot around that kind of language. They're like, oh, no, they okay, like,
I'm not
great.
Interested.
I'm not interested in this conversation. Can we move it along? Yes, absolutely.
I think before we sort of, I mean, I'm pretty sure we've touched all bases here on what we need to do.
You'd hope so. Nearly 3 hours into pod. Yeah.
3 hours with multiple films to come up. We've got Eclectic 18s. We've got pods from some of these places. We're going to do some editorial stuff. You know, we really want to bring this stuff to light and do it in a tasteful way. So I think there's much else left in the locker.
There's a few little bits. The drive home, I think, if you're going to go on a tour like we did, don't do it at half term. That was pretty, going through the passport control at half term was a pickle.
That was a little bit bleak, wasn't it? Yeah, but even the Flexi Plus couldn't save us.
I would like to say, if anyone has made it through to this point, there's a few bits. First of all, I think you've got the point, but
we're giving away a free tailor-made driver to anyone who makes it this far.
Just drop us an email, no giveaway required. Yeah.
It's like that sort of experiment with the terms and conditions. Anyone who reads the page 85 of these dense TNCs
gets their mortgage paid off.
Yeah, I mean, if you've got this far, I'm sure you're getting the point. Like, it is 100% worth a visit. And if you get the opportunity or you have the desire, please, please get in touch with some of these clubs and get out there, because it's just... The whole reason we started all this stuff is we want to share the love, and I really want to be able to speak to people and be like, how good is Dapan?
Yeah.
How good is Kenema? How good is Noordwijk? And, you know, have a chance to do it. It would be remiss if we didn't say another huge thank you individually to each one of the people who hosted us or helped us organize the trip. Like, we wouldn't have got it without it.
Yeah. So, Case Collart, Barent Van Dam. We're going to go through
Christian
that.
Boomer. Yeah. Martin Delfortree.
Willem van Steenberg. Peter von Steenberg as well. Yeah, and Richard White. As well as Lucas from Kenema, course manager.
Amazing guys.
It's the people you meet along the way that really kind of enrich these experiences. Totally. So,
don't forget the guy that watches unpack all the FootJoy gear on the... on the shuttle. It was just staring at us like we had three heads. Just
boxes of FootJoy stuff.
Just going through boxes.
Jokes
boxes
aside,
of stuff.
You know, it was also not free. So, you know, the FootJoy has supported us with this is well appreciated, I think. And, you know, we are big fans of FootJoy. You know, it's the start of a good relationship.
And the gloves. There. Just a moment for the gloves.
Gloves.
We've got to do some individual bits on this. I don't know if we can do it justice. The shoes, the gloves, the trousers, the belts.
I mean, we don't have to go into it. I'm just like, literally, I actually feel this is proper against brand to do this, but yeah, the gloves were nice, weren't they?
Gloves were great. I love a Cabretta glove. The Premier's are just an outstanding shoe. I've actually got to slow down this FootJoy fetish that seems to be growing at the moment. I'm getting carried away with it at the moment.
Going out and buying sort of age-old models, like vintage collection.
Right. We are going to wrap it there. Yeah.
If you've made it this far, well done to you. Gold star. Just get in touch with Bruce. He's going to send you a driver.
And Tom, can I just close this by saying what a wonderful job you've done on those films? I have every faith they're going to be as beautiful, if not more beautiful, than the thing you made. But you've basically got until year end now in the edit room. By the time this comes out, you will be like fed up of feedback on films.
Yeah. And just to really be the cherry that caps it off, you know, there's going to be a little bit of editing this pod as well, which I think might be a little bit challenging too. But you know,
and I forgot to mention round of the tour, Bruce's 68 to pun.
Oh,
hang on. No, that's a horrible bit of pigeonholing at the end of the pod.
No, that was class. That was the best golf of the tour. That was the finest, probably some of the finest golf I've ever seen you play.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, that's very kind, but absolutely not warranted. We're here to talk about Dutch golf, and we hope you enjoyed listening to this.
On the point,
to be fair, it sounds best round tour. We shot a 78 at some point around that. It was really good.
Shot low round. Thank you and good night.
Adios.
Watch this.